Welcome back to the Native Waters on Arid Lands podcast, where we're talking with different members of our project team about their work. This is Kelsey Fitzgerald, and today I'm here with Native Waters team member Helen Fillmore, who has recently graduated from the University of Nevada, Reno with a master's degree in hydrologic sciences. Her advisor, Dr. Loretta Singletary, is also a member of our team, and we spoke to her in the last episode of the podcast. Hi, Helen. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. I'm excited to be here.
To start with, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and your area of expertise?
Yes. Dewatla umet degum dia le'i, bawaluda de'i le'i, ashwashu le'i. Hello, everyone. My name is Helen Fillmore. I am part of the Washu tribe, and I grew up on the Dresslerville Reservation just south of Carson City. My education background, as already noted, is hydrologic sciences. When I came into the field of hydrology, I wanted to come into an interdisciplinary program. And the reason why I'm interested in interdisciplinary research is because it's one of the easiest ways, even though it's really challenging because you have a lot of very different disciplines trying to work on a topic that might be interconnected but complicated. But I think that it's one of the most effective ways to make our research real for stakeholders, for community members, and so those are, in a summary, my background and interests.
So your master's research involved a survey that you implemented at the 2016 and 2017 Native Waters on Arid Lands Tribal Summits. Can you tell us a little bit about what you studied?
Yes, so the Native Waters on Arid Lands project is such a large project involving multiple states, multiple watersheds, multiple universities, and a lot of indigenous communities and stakeholders. And so my advisor, Dr. Loretta Singletary, her background is in participatory research, which is a kind of research methodology that focuses on collaborative engagement with the communities who she works with. And so in this case, it's with indigenous communities. And so the first summit, 2015, the researchers did kind of more of a qualitative analysis of the participants at that summit as far as kind of what they would like to see in climate adaptation initiatives and how we could help fill some of the gaps in that work. And so what we wanted to do from there was to take some of that information from other research studies involving climate change in the U.S. and implement a questionnaire, but a needs assessment survey. And we had 50 questions total. And the goal of this was to assess the climate data and information needs of the indigenous communities who were a part of this project, and just to develop a better understanding of their priorities and how we can work and engage with them in a more meaningful way at that regional scale. This is really important, I think, in the United States to start with this type of engagement, at least to actually hear from the communities that you're working with, particularly when a lot of what we've seen over the last 4 years with this project, but then in the way that society has been transitioning in the U.S., is that we're really seeing indigenous communities are leading a lot of the conversation around climate action and trying to adapt and mitigate to climate change. And so honoring those efforts and not trying to say, focus on indigenous community vulnerability, which it's not to say that indigenous communities aren't vulnerable to climate change. In a lot of ways, their vulnerability is what has driven so many communities to work so hard in adapting for the future. At the same time, because they're leading that charge, how do we better help them? How do we fill some of the gaps that they need? And so in our survey, we really tried to focus on resiliency and on the very specific climate data and information needs that they might need a little bit more assistance on or that they might prioritize over others.
So Helen, in learning about the climate data needs of indigenous communities, what were some of the takeaways? Like, what did you learn from your research?
The biggest takeaways that we found from this study was a little bit surprising on one end and then not so surprising at the other end. The highest prioritized need was, of course, assisting with climate adaptation information specific to reservation lands. And then from there, a less surprising but also highly prioritized need was the role that traditional knowledge plays in climate adaptation initiatives. And this one, although not surprising, is a kind of challenging topic because when it comes to traditional knowledge and using it in climate change, our climate is changing at a rapid pace. And so when you're considering just traditional knowledge, you're considering the land use practices, the cultural values, the community networks that have existed and have kept Indigenous communities resilient in their homelands for thousands of years. But the current climate conditions and projections are not what they have ever been within that time period. And so maybe they would be for a year or something like that, but not at such a high scale. And so that question of what is the role that traditional knowledge can play in climate adaptation is I think a really complex question, and a question that I like to say it's not something that can really come from outside researchers, but really is an opportunity for Indigenous communities to work with their cultural knowledge holders, their traditional knowledge holders, and community members to see what that looks like for them moving forward. That was one big takeaway. Another big takeaway, when we're looking specifically at climate data, kind of across the board, no matter how we differentiated our stakeholder groups, we found that water quality was the highest prioritized data need. And I have quite a few different theories after talking to my advisor and other researchers, my committee members too, for why that might be, because research on climate impacts on water quality, people aren't taking that and running with that yet. One, water quality is defined differently depending on what you're considering, whether it's drinking water quality of lakes, whether it's contaminated sites, things like that. And so it's not a specifically defined term. And then on top of that, I think one of the other reasons that it might have become such a high priority is that there isn't really a lot of water quality data available to the communities within kind of our general research area. It's a lot easier to access precipitation data. It's a lot easier to access temperature data, but to access water quality data, that type of data is just not quite available.
So a lot of our work in the Native Waters Project is focused around the idea of resilience and building resilience to climate change. How did you define resilience in your thesis work?
Yeah, a lot of times when we are working with communities outside of our own, and particularly outside of, you know, academics, right? How we define resilience in, you know, academia might not be how our communities are defining resilience. And a lot of times when we define it as, you know, having a diverse economy so that if one sector of that economy fails, there's something else to keep the community going, or having biodiversity so that if, you know, one of those resources fails, there's another type. But when it comes to each individual community, they're all going to define resilience a little bit differently. And so I think this was a little bit of a miscommunication, I would say, in some of my earlier talks with stakeholders and with some of the participants at our summits, is that we kind of had our understanding of resiliency, and the communities that we were working for had a different definition. And in my thesis, I just highlight this point because I think it's important to listen to what their definitions are. How do they define it for themselves? A theme in a lot of Indigenous cultures is that looking seven generations ahead. So resilience to them has nothing to do with the economy, has nothing to do with policies, it has nothing to do with things that we kind of see tangible now, but it has everything to do with how are the future generations going to be able to exist and thrive in the lands that their people and those cultures always have. But that's just one example of, you know, potentially multiple definitions of resiliency. And so I think honoring that those community definitions in our research is really important with moving forward.
So in addition to Helen's thesis research that we've just been hearing about, Helen also worked with Native Waters team members Loretta Singletary and John Phillips on a similar study looking at the climate adaptation needs of tribal colleges and universities. We have posted links to that, and we'll also post links to some of her other work on our website at nativewaters-airedlands.com. Helen, since graduating I understand that you've been working with the Forest Service and the Washoe community up in Lake Tahoe. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Yeah, so the project with the Forest Service, it was co-funded by the Forest Service and the Wildlife Society, and it's a Native American research assistantship where they try to expose undergraduates, graduate students, and recent graduates with, I guess, working in a Forest Service type of a setting. So our supervisors were both employees at the Pacific Southwest Research Center, I think, with the Forest Service. But the reason why I decided to do that project was because the ultimate goal of that research project was to restore degraded meadow ecosystems in the Tahoe Basin. And Jonathan Long, who's one of my supervisors on that project, he's done a lot of work in Indian country, and he was really interested in seeing the role that Washoe cultural practices prevented degradation from happening in the first place. And so what kind of plants that were prioritized and valued among the Washoe people, and how they kind of, in quotations, managed those meadows to enhance those plants as a way to kind of not only restore the meadows, but then also create resilient meadow ecosystems to protect them from climate change. And so this project really was more of a collaboration where we were working with Washoe elders and youth and community members to try to inform restoration treatments. So we did quite a few interviews, also did a lot of outreach. So kind of as we would learn some things, then we would present it back to the community and present it back to youth in workshops. So that way it's not done outside of the community, but then, you know, as we're restoring these ecosystems, also restoring kind of that connection that was lost, and that really did signify a lot of the degradation that occurred in these areas. And so in a lot of ways, this was using Indigenous knowledge in a real way and community participation to restore these areas. And then what we also saw was revitalization of more of our language, revitalization of some of this plant knowledge that's kind of been not lost, but set aside for a while. And what we're hoping is that we'll get more community involvement in the future, and that this will lead to more resilient ecosystems, more resilient cultural knowledge and cultural uses, and more resilient community kind of down the line. But we were essentially just planting some seeds this summer to keep that going. And then the other side of that project is also doing vegetation assessments to try to analyze how the meadows have changed over time, or will change over time depending on certain treatments, and what plants are going to come back depending on treatment. So the plan for one of these meadows, it was burned in a prescribed burn last year to remove conifer trees. And then there is a plan right now to first thin out the meadow, thin out the conifer trees, and then the plan is to try to put fire on the ground. I'm not sure if they'll be able to do that because it's so challenging to do prescribed burning. There's so much red tape on public lands, but even after the thinning and the water table raises, because the water's not being consumed by these giant trees or these lots of little tiny trees. To see which plants come back from that will be really interesting, and the community's excited to learn about that too.
That's awesome. That sounds like a really cool project.
Yeah, it was really awesome to be able to kind of take what I learned from the Native Waters on Arid Lands as far as engaging community in collaborative and ways and in partnerships, and then apply it on a more focused project, I guess, in a smaller area. And so for me, it felt like it made some of our findings more real. So it was an example to show how, you know, well, we've found these things, but how do we facilitate this? How do we help with this? How do we kind of fill some of these communication gaps or information needs, data needs? And in that way, it was demonstrated that it is possible. And that was really an exciting opportunity to be a part of for me.
That's really neat. So now that you've graduated, what's next for you? What do you hope to do with your career?
Yeah, so what's next? Graduated, I am on a serious job hunt, but I'm kind of taking it easy for a little while. I would love to continue working with Indigenous communities in climate and enhancing climate adaptation and resiliency. There aren't a lot of job opportunities at that specific level, but my ultimate goal would be to put my degree to use and really going to water resources work and hydrologic types of studies and things of that nature. But we'll see what opens up. So I'm excited though.
Great. Well, thank you so much for talking with us. It was really interesting to hear about your work, and best of luck with whatever comes next.
Yeah, thank you, Kelsey. This was fun.
Funding for Native Waters on Arid Lands is provided by the United States Department of Agriculture, National Institute of Food and Agriculture. If you'd like to learn more about the Native Waters on Arid Lands project, please visit our website at nativewaters-aridlands.com, where you can find more episodes of this podcast and also supplemental information to go along with each episode. Thanks for listening.